From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll learn about the Bridge Project, Milwaukee's first unconditional cash program for eligible pregnant people. Then, our new series, Politics Through the Prism of the Environment, explores why environmental issues are so important to some voters.
Right now, we are in our sixth largest extinction in Earth's history. Due to anthropogenic sources like fossil fuel burning, deforestation, urbanization, and so many other things.
Plus, we'll explore what life is like for two Muslim artists in Milwaukee in a series called Group Chat.
Sometimes I do wonder, like, if one day I will get canceled, if I will have, like, opportunities taken from me or prevented from me even, like, considering because of how outspoken I've become.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll hear from two Muslim artists in Milwaukee in conversation with one another for a new series called Group Chat. But we'll start with this. In Wisconsin, about 1 in 7 children lives in poverty. Milwaukee has the second highest poverty rate among the top 50 most populated American cities. A new program is working to break the generational cycle of stress and poverty and put cash into the hands of those who need it most. The Bridge Project, a nonprofit based in New York City, focuses on getting direct cash transfers to pregnant people. The program serves low to moderate income pregnant people to make sure they have adequate financial stability in the first 1,000 days of their baby's life. For the first time, the Bridge Project is expanding outside of New York and offering the program here in Milwaukee, thanks to a partnership with the Zilber Foundation. To learn more about the project and the partnership, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with the Zilber Family Foundation's Executive Director, Gina Stilp.
How does this work align with what the Zilber Foundation focuses on to begin with?
So the Zilber Family Foundation is a nonprofit that awards grant dollars to charitable organizations. Our mission is to advance social and economic opportunity, and we do most of our work here in Milwaukee. And for many years, we have been focused on improving quality of life in three particular neighborhoods in Milwaukee: Lindsay Heights on the north side, and Clark Square and Layton Boulevard West on the south side. And a lot of our work has gone to support economic advancement. And that traditionally looks more like working through nonprofit organizations that are delivering a program or a service. So it might be an affordable housing program or job training or financial literacy and skill building. But this is a bit of a deviation for us. It's the first time that we have partnered with an organization that is getting cash with no strings attached directly into the hands of residents of our neighborhoods. And so for us, we see it as kind of working on two sides of the same coin, which is one, let's make sure that individuals not only have financial security, but autonomy and dignity in using resources that are intended to help them be stable. And then on the other side, also working with nonprofit organizations in our community that can wrap around all kinds of other supports, whether it's housing supports, economic development, or health and wellness for mom and baby.
So let's talk about some of the factors that this unconditional payment can help. How serious is poverty and a lack of economic security here in Milwaukee, and especially for the populations that you focus on?
So in the neighborhoods where the foundation focuses, we see over 40% child poverty, which just is a really astounding number when you just stop and think about that. And what that looks like is, you know, we have families who can't afford to put food on the table, who make that very difficult decision every month around, do I pay my rent or do I pay my electric bill? And what happens then is that families are uprooted. They have high levels of housing insecurity. That trickle down then becomes, you know, poor outcomes in school. It's higher crime rates. It's less stability in a neighborhood. And ultimately, it impacts physical and mental health. And so for us, we see this as an opportunity to get money directly into people who are, you know, low income or living in poverty currently, and give them an opportunity to catch their breath at a turning point in their life when there's a new baby in their family and just be able to have a little sense of peace that they're going to be able to cover their expenses for, you know, the next 2 years.
Now, I know there's a national precedent for unconditional cash payment programs, but to your knowledge, has there been anything like this here in Milwaukee preceding what you're doing with the Bridge Project?
I think this is the first time we've seen a program like this come to Milwaukee. There are certainly mutual aid groups that have been offering help to one another or to folks in their community in a more informal way. But I think this is the first time we've said, you know, we're allocating $1.5 million to support this initiative, and we're going to make sure that the same 100 families get the same payments on a monthly basis for the next 2 years.
So as you mentioned, the Bridge Project provides unconditional cash to 100 eligible low-income pregnant individuals in Milwaukee for 2 years. So what is the criteria to be accepted, and how can people apply?
So we are looking to support individuals who are 18 years or older, who are 23 weeks pregnant or less. And the idea there is that we'll be able to connect mom with some prenatal resources before baby's born and get a prenatal stipend to her, just so that everyone's starting out on the right foot. And then we're targeting the neighborhoods where Zilber Family Foundation has worked, which would be Lindsay Heights, Clark Square, and Layton Boulevard West. And we're also looking to support the zip code areas that encompass those communities. So that's the 04, 05, 06, and 15 zip codes in Milwaukee. And we're also targeting a particular income. So families need to have a household income of less than $39,000 a year.
And when do applications close? Is it a rolling thing over the course of 2 years? What are some of those details?
Right now, it's a rolling application process. We opened applications on April 10th. And as of early last week, it sounded like we had about 30 families, 30 individuals who are going through the sort of verification process right now to be enrolled in the program. And then we'll continue to take applications and screen for our eligibility criteria over the next, I would guess, probably 8 weeks or so. Our goal is to, you know, fill the spots as quickly as we can. And then once we get to that 100 individuals enrolled in the program and they're receiving their cash payments, those are the same individuals who will stay in the program for the 2 year duration.
Okay, gotcha. And so once you've gotten these individuals, they're enrolled in the program, you truly mean no strings attached, right? How do you see this simple principle as the key to economic empowerment?
You know, I think a lot of us forget or just don't know that for people who are low income and who are looking for supports, whether it be through SNAP or food stamps or, you know, some other government benefit that are incredibly helpful, it also requires a lot of work. So there's a lot of paperwork, there's a lot of verification, there's just a bit of loss of dignity in the process of applying for and continuing to report on your poverty. And so this allows trust building between an organization and low-income women in particular. It allows mom to feel empowered that she can make good choices and that she knows best about how to handle her household and how to deliver the most essential items and services that her family needs. And I think for us too, the important differentiator of the no strings attached is, while data shows us that the, you know, large preponderance of the funding that is awarded, the cash transfers that are awarded, are spent on basic needs, you know, food, formula, rent, childcare, transportation, there's also the opportunity for families to have a birthday party and buy a birthday cake or take a summer trip, you know, on a vacation, or sign up your kids for a summer camp that before maybe would have been really unattainable. And so those are the opportunities that the unrestricted cash offers that, you know, maybe a more restrictive or government-based program just wouldn't allow for.
You mentioned this often goes towards, you know, everyday needs, especially to have that flexibility. But can you share any feedback that you've heard or read in your partnership leading up with the Bridge Project? Given that you're still looking for applications here, we don't know, you know, what that will be put towards here necessarily. But what's been the feedback or result data elsewhere?
In New York in particular, there's a huge increase in the number of families who are able to save for that emergency. As you said, it's hard to save anything. And so I think we love that there's, after women are enrolled in the program, they're thinking about that, right? They're thinking about, how do I save when this money runs out? Or how do I save for the next emergency next month? We also see, you know, a big percentage of families, as you said, basic needs, but there's definitely a trend where moms are able to enroll in additional educational opportunities for themselves, or are able to take a pause and think about, you know, what is my next career opportunity? And so maybe taking a day off work to go interview for a job, really thinking about what is the economic advancement that the family can have with this extra funding. And I think, you know, we'll see anecdotally, it might be a security deposit on a better apartment in a safer neighborhood, or it might be putting those first dollars into a savings account for a down payment on a future home. So there's both the immediate needs that are being met, but then these longer term investments in family and instability that are really inspiring.
So what would success look like for you, for Milwaukee participants, for this collaboration and partnership?
Oh, there's so many. I think first and foremost, we want to make sure that the families that we're helping are obtaining that financial stability. And with that financial stability, that they'll see some social benefit around the health and wellness of their families. I think second, you know, we're really interested in building bridges between the participants of the Bridge Program and the many nonprofit organizations that already exist in Milwaukee. And we've just been overwhelmed by the positive response. You know, we had a community webinar and we had over 100 organizations and individuals participate and reach back to us and say, we want to make sure that the moms in the program know about what else is out here. And so I think it's a great opportunity for us to wrap around services and see what happens when we can be very intentional about serving moms pre and postnatal and serving babies in those first 1,000 days and, you know, really helping in brain development at the earliest stages of life. So those are kind of big buckets for us. The other, I think, opportunity the Bridge Project brings to Milwaukee is we're really igniting the opportunity to have a conversation. And for us, the conversation is around, first and foremost, you know, what are the assumptions we have about poor people and why do we have them? And then, you know, secondly, I hope at the end of this, we can prove that by giving moms autonomy, giving families autonomy to make financial decisions about their families, that we'll see success and that this will spur additional investment and perhaps break down some of those walls on how families can access the resources that they need just to survive.
As you mentioned, the note of you have to prove to in order to get other nonprofits or state agencies involved, right? So do you plan on, you know, not necessarily tracking the quote unquote results, but are there research opportunities that you're taking with this?
So one of the big benefits of working with the Bridge Project is that they worked very closely with Columbia and University of Pennsylvania when they launched the program 3 years ago and were very rigorous in their research and evaluation. And so we have the first 3 years of the New York project's data to sort of validate that this works. Going forward, we'll continue to work with the Bridge Project's research arm to do surveys throughout the 2 years, but they're optional for the moms to opt into. So it's not required that they participate. And if the moms do choose to participate, we compensate them for that additional work. But what the Bridge Project has seen in New York is that there is a deep willingness to engage and that the moms are not only, you know, willing to talk about their story and the benefits of the cash, but, you know, eager to make sure that not only the Bridge Project, but that the community at large knows that there's a huge benefit in operating programs like this. So I think, you know, we'll kind of pair the data collection and analysis on the spending habits with some of the more qualitative information around just overall well-being of the families in the program.
Well, Gina, this is a really exciting program to come, and I look forward to hopefully talking to you again to see how it goes.
Yeah, we can't wait. Thank you so much, Audrey.
Gina Stilpe is the executive director of the Zilber Family Foundation, and she joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. You can learn more about their partnership with the Bridge Project and how to apply at WUWM.com. WUWM is asking Wisconsin voters what's on their minds ahead of the November presidential election and elections for state and local offices. Many people have told us that climate change and other environmental issues are top of mind. In response, WUWM is launching a series we're calling Politics Through the Prism of the Environment. It starts with conversations our environmental reporter Susan Benz had with two young people about what they want elected officials to know. First, we'll hear from recent UW-Milwaukee grad Zaya Lowry. Later, we'll hear from restoration ecologist Phi Tong Tao. Here's Lowry.
So it started when I took my first AP Environmental Science course in high school, and although it was not a required course, I took it just to kind of get the college credit at the time. And after taking the course and learning about, you know, sustainability and wildlife conservation and all these topics that I had never heard of before, it was shocking. It was truly shocking. I was 16 years old at the time, and I was honestly devastated because I'm learning about these huge topics that we're facing right now. Why haven't I heard about these things sooner? And so as soon as I took this class, I became so passionate right in the moment. You can even ask my mom, who's sitting next to me. You know, I immediately said, we need to start composting. And I went vegetarian. I switched all of our straws out to reusable straws. I was on a rampage, seriously, around the house. And ever since then, I just knew I had to be part of the environmental movement and wanted to learn more. And so, you know, of course, I started college and started the environmental science path. And actually, that was during COVID. So I was a 2020 graduate of high school, and starting my college career online was really difficult, both mentally and educationally, just not getting what I wanted out of my college experience. And then once, you know, things started to open up a little bit more around campus, I really wanted to start getting involved. And that's when I started working with the Conservation Club and eventually became president of that club. Have been in that position for the last 2 years.
Has your mind had time to go into the thoughts of policies?
Absolutely. And recently I had just marched in the climate march in Madison, and they were talking about divestment from fossil fuels. And I think that is a huge, huge topic that should be on the forefront of our current elections and our upcoming elections. And I'm really excited to get out there and vote. And not only that, but I did vote in our last April election. And one thing that really surprised me was that most of the candidates were running unopposed. I hate it. I hate it. You know, only having one choice, that's not a democracy. And so making sure that not only are we voting, but we're getting involved in local government and trying to fill some of those roles and compete against others to really make sure that we have the best candidates in charge.
You mentioned the march and demonstrations. What role do you think that sort of lobbying and activism plays in what transpires, what policies are passed?
Yeah, absolutely. I think getting involved in, like you said, demonstrations, marches, petitions of any sort, just shows how passionate you are and how willing you are to not only get out and take time out of your day, but to really raise awareness on important topics. And, you know, we recently had a petition at UWM in regards to the Palestinian and Israeli conflict, and they really got what they wanted out of that petition or march, or I'm not sure of the correct terminology, but they really got what they were looking for. And if they would never have done that demonstration, UWM would never have changed. And so change is so, so, so important, and making sure that you're getting involved and doing what you can really in your own time to not only show others and raise awareness, but to, you know, get your voice out, get your voice heard. So important.
Can you distill your number one concern? What is preoccupies you most that needs to be addressed?
There are so many issues that are at the forefront of my mind when it comes to the environmental movement. I think first, the issue of water, and not only clean water, but access to water. And as you know, we are right next to the Great Lakes, and I'm so grateful that we are. But to protect the Great Lakes Compact is at the forefront of my mind as a Wisconsinite, and should be at the forefront of others, because, you know, now that they diverted some water to Waukesha, that can open up some things that we don't want opened up. We want to protect our water. And so that's number one. And number two is protecting our endangered species, because right now we are in our sixth largest extinction in Earth's history due to anthropogenic sources like fossil fuel burning, deforestation, urbanization, and so many other things. And so protecting our wildlife so that, you know, our kids can enjoy the giraffes and enjoy the pandas and enjoy this beautiful earth that we get to enjoy every single day.
If you have, and you probably will have, the opportunity to talk to elected officials, for those in office, to those running for office, what do you want elected officials to know is important to you?
I want them to know that climate change and global warming is important, it's real, it's happening now, and to take that into consideration when they are passing bills and when they are approving legislation, because I know that's at the back of some, you know, candidates' minds, and understandably so. We have a lot of issues at hand currently, but you know, our environment is not waiting for us. It's going to continue to decline and decline, and you know, my grandchildren, they're not going to see the same things that I can see today. And it's so important to not only protect our current resources, but make sure that our kids have those same access to resources. And that's all I got to say for those officials, because I really do believe that we are going to be the generation of change. I truly believe that.
So my name is Phi Tong Tao. I'm a restoration ecologist for Sitch Audubon Nature Center. We're sitting in front of Molly's Pond, which is a body of water that's surrounded by a bunch of native pond emergence. There's pickerel weed in front of us. There's some green bulrush around us. And, you know, occasionally if you hear in the background, you might hear some frogs peeping around and some migrating birds.
When you think of the work that you do, does policy and the people we elect to craft that policy, is that on your mind?
It is. Well, when I was younger, I really didn't think about it because, you know, I'm a teenager. I just want to work. But as I got older, and then when I worked for the Conservancy, it kind of became more and more apparent where it's like, hey, during the Trump administration, there was a lot of EPA bills that were kind of flipped. I think they lessened up some protection on Yosemite for, you know, oil drilling and all that stuff, which made me really, really sad and devastated, because I spent a month working out there, you know, doing trail building, learning a lot about cultural aspects about there. And it's like, here we are, we're going to raise all this, start drilling for oils, and just destroy such a fragile ecosystem. It's hard to replicate that. You know, once you remove all those like super fine, like small ecosystems, like it's hard to replicate that. You know, with Tony Evers, he's a bird nerd. He has a background in biology, I think. And I know with him, you know, I think he just bought a bunch of, like he gave federal funding to buy a bunch of land in the Northwoods. He's trying to keep the Knowles Nelson grant going. We shouldn't get rid of the Knowles Nelson grant, because that's one of the biggest things that's keeping a lot of our public lands funded. You know, that should just stay, it shouldn't be bothered with. But, you know, I'm only one person telling who's ever going to listen to this. So I'm hoping people actually will pick up on this and be like, oh yeah, that's the reason why we still have our parks the way they are, and like our waters are so clean and all the other stuff.
When it comes to advocating, where do you see the role of lobbying? And I know there's different sorts of lobbying and activism.
Right.
Can those approaches make a difference?
I think it can. I mean, once again, it all breaks down to how extreme you're going to be as a person. For me, it's like, I tell people, you know, it's like, when I used to work with youth crews, I always tell them, like, hey, you know, like, you're 18, talk to your local politicians, get your aldermen or alderwomen involved. That's the best thing you can do as someone who's just started their adulthood. Like, become an advocate for what you want to do and what you want to see. That's all I have for that.
What is your central or biggest concern?
Globally, it has to be climate change. It's kind of in our faces. You know, we're having hotter summers, warmer winters. You know, that could lead to massive, like, opening a massive can of worms. Things are growing a lot quicker. You know, garlic mites are starting to pop up a lot earlier. Dame's Rock is starting to flower. That leads into more intense fires. That's a big thing right now that a lot of people are fearing. You know, are these massive wildfires that are happening in California, northern Wisconsin, all over the U.S., even outside of Canada, where it's like you just need to start doing more like healthier burns. We need to start incorporating like healthier, low intensity fires that kind of reduce all the heavy fuel loads. And you know, that's just for me as personally, it's like that's what I want to see more like federally. For locally, I think it has to do with a lot of like health, like mental health and emotional health, especially in Milwaukee. You know, we have such a big green space that's not being utilized by a lot of like youth of color. I was a crew lead for youth of color. A lot of them some of them are like, I never knew we had this out here in Milwaukee. I've never been on this side of town before, or I've never been this far up here. This is really, really cool. And there's definitely a massive disconnect between urbanized areas and kind of areas of affluence that have ease of access to like Lake Michigan, you know, a place like Sitch Audubon or Milwaukee County Park, such as like the East, like Doctors Park, where like they're kind of tucked away in nicer neighborhoods or kind of far away, that's out of ease of access for a lot of youth.
Phi Tong Tao is a restoration ecologist at Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. Zaya Lowry is a recent UW-Milwaukee grad with a degree in conservation and environmental science. They spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz as part of our series, Politics Through the Prism of the Environment. You can share what's on your mind ahead of the November election by filling out our survey at wuwm.com/election.
Support for environmental reporting is provided in part by BRICO Fund.
WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why it's so important in this year's election. New episodes drop every Wednesday leading up to the Republican National Convention. You can find it wherever you like to listen to podcasts. In about 15 minutes, we'll explore the roots of Wisconsin's dairy industry and what it means to be a modern-day dairy farmer. But first, we'll hear from two Muslim artists and their experiences making art in Milwaukee for a new series called Group Chat. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Today we're starting a new series that aims to get Milwaukeeans in conversation with each other, letting them ask their own questions to one another while we provide the mics and get out of the way. It's called Group Chat. Our first sit-down is between two Muslim artists talking about their art-making journeys in Milwaukee.
Do I just start? I just start talking to the mic? My name is Leila Amin, and I'm an artist here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm also a therapeutic arts facilitator, and I've been working as like an artist for the last, oh my gosh, probably like 7 or 8 years, like taking it seriously. But I've always known I've wanted to be an artist since I was like very small.
My name's Amel Azam, or Amel Azam, Azam. professionally, I guess I work at a refugee resettlement agency. I do that. The extra time that I do have, I work on my art practice. I also am a co-founder of Fanana Banana, which is a kind of like a little movement that started in 2017 to give Muslim artists a space to represent themselves and show their work to their own community, because that didn't really exist before.
I'm honestly like very curious what your experience was like in art school, especially at Peck.
Mine wasn't very great. It was really hard for me to make friends. Most of the professors, like, I only had like two professors that really made me feel like I was no different than anyone else in the room.
Mm.
All through like the first year until I graduated, I just felt that looming sense of like just not fitting in and like trying to fit in, and it just never really worked. So like after my first or second year, I kind of just gave up. I was like, this is just not going to happen. Like, I don't know how to find a way to connect with my classmates.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I kind of chalked it up to like, I'm not rooming with anybody. Like, mm-hmm. I'm going to campus and I'm going home to my parents' house. Like, maybe that's what it is.
Yeah.
But, like, in the classrooms themselves, like, it was so difficult to the point where I didn't realize it at the time. But I feel like now when I really think about it, like, I was the only Muslim woman in every single classroom. And then the minorities in the classroom just kept decreasing, like, the further I got into the program. Honestly, they were, like, the most talented people in the class, but they just kept dropping out and changing majors. It wasn't great. Like, there were times where I feel like I should have gotten, like, some praise from professors because I was trying so damn hard, and, like, it was just, like, completely ignored.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, group projects were hell because nobody wanted to meet with me. And I'm not going to cry.
No.
But it was just, so weird. So I'm like,
yeah.
What am I, like... I'm just a person. Like, it's
yeah.
really, it's not that big of a deal to me. But then I also would go to school, like, wearing the kufiya. Because at the time, it was, like, what, like,
yeah,
still post-9/11?
It would have been, like, early 2010s.
Because
mm-hmm. I graduated from UWM December 2014. And I remember there were pretty active, like, Muslim groups on that campus and, like, a very active SJP. So there was always places that you could go to feel like, oh, I'm around people who, like, get me. But a lot of the other, like,
Muslim and Arab students, they did not go to art school.
No,
they were all
like the only one.
Yeah, it was like they were all in the like engineering program or architecture
business.
Or like one of the like, you know, business or something in the biology. So they're on the opposite side of campus. So you are quite literally like physically isolated from everyone else too. Mm-hmm. There's this thing where it's like I don't know if you can relate too, but it's like, you know, we both went to Saddam School. It's a very tight-knit community. We both went to St. John Antietam. That's a very diverse high school.
It is.
And everyone was just so accepting. Like, mm-hmm. it never became an issue that it's like, oh, no. I'm going to, like,
maybe
openly.
That's what it was.
Yeah. But then you get TWM, where it's supposed to be, like, the quote-unquote adult world, like, your introduction to that, and people suddenly treat you like an other. And it's very jarring. What made me, like, almost give up entirely on, like, art making was, like, the final critique that I had. They brought in a like local artist, like professional artist, and they would give you feedback. And this would happen kind of like throughout the semester, but this last one was like the big one where it's like, okay, you're presenting your entire thesis, your portfolio, your artist statement, like if you had a website at the time. And I did that. So the artist that they brought in, which I have run into because they have a studio in my building and I don't think they remember me, but I remember them. Mm. At the time, I was making these garments, like wearable garments, and I didn't have a model because I'm a broke 20-something-year-old. So I used my younger sister as a model, like her wearing these outfits. And she was like 15 or 16. In the pictures that I took of her, I, like, cropped her face out. Like, I cropped her head out because I'm like, she's a minor. She's a child. And if I were to post these, like, on a website for a portfolio, like, I don't want her face. Like, that's for her own safety. So as I'm presenting my portfolio to this class, to the teacher, to this artist, in no way did I mention politics. I mentioned, like, how the symbols I was using related back to, like, Islamic faith. But there was nothing political about that. So I end, and the first question I get was from this artist, and she was like, why is her face cropped out? Like, why is her head cropped out? And I was like, it's my younger sister, and she's, like, a minor, so it's for her own privacy. This woman says, just for context, this was 2014, she said, well, given the political climate, I just don't think it's wise of you to have a woman that's beheaded in your photos.
Beheaded?
Yes, without her head. And I didn't say anything. I just kind of looked at her and, like, no one said anything.
Oh.
No one corrected her. No one said, where are you getting that from?
Right.
That was the only feedback she gave me. She said nothing about my artist statement. She said nothing about the quality of my work. I mean, after that, I mean, I graduated shortly after that, and I almost gave up on art. Like, I didn't make art for almost 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Because I was so just disheartened. I was like, that's it. That's how people are going to view me. Like, I'm just this object, like, for them to throw their own, like, bias on.
Mm-hmm.
So that was rough. That was really rough.
That's crazy. I'm sorry you had to go through that. Because, like, I'm sure it's, like, such an intimate setting, too.
Yeah.
Because, like, you carry so much of understanding that you're perceived through so many misconceptions, and then you have to take that home, and then you have to decide what to do with it. And then sometimes it's like, I don't want to deal with it.
I mean, that's a question that I want to ask you for sure, because I mean, I'm not Palestinian, and I'm only like half Lebanese. Like, my mom is a white convert. So, like, knowing that you are, have you ever felt before PEC, or like while you were in art school or afterwards, like the level of self-censorship that maybe you've had to encounter and what that's been like, and now in comparison to like how that's changed or if that's changed?
It's funny because I remember I did like a presentation in college. I must have been a junior, and it was like, you know, like the big lecture halls that you like take like art history in and everything. I don't know why I was doing a presentation, but it was literally about Palestine, and I had like images up, and I had like everything, like it was like completely raw and everything. And after doing like a whole presentation where I like at the end of it, I was so choked up and like ready to cry, and seeing how no one really knew what I was talking about, I went home and I was like, I can't do this anymore. And that's when the self-censorship started to come in, and I didn't realize how bad it was. I was worried of people that were perceived to be on the right side of history, viewing my work and seeing me as like the villain of like the terrorist, of like the troublemaker. And I was like just worried almost all the time. Yeah, the self-censorship is still there, especially after October as mm-hmm. well, because I have been like, before I post anything, I'll send it to friends and I'm like, do you think I should share this? Do you think I should share it? Like, do you think it's okay? Do you think it's worth sharing? Do you think people would understand it? And like,
I mean, it's interesting because like, I mean, I totally understand when it's like I'm only making work for the aesthetic quality, because it's like, I think I was so burned by that final like critique that I got that I was like, if I put anything related to culture about me being Arab, about me being a Muslim woman, like my work's just going to get dismissed. Oh, it's political work. Like, we do not care. So like my work, like when I started to get back into like making art, like painting again, had very little to do with my identity. It was very surface level because I was playing it very safe. I was like, I am not going to, you know, ruffle anyone's feathers. I'm going to just keep my head down, not say anything. And if people like how my artwork looks, that's great. But whenever it was asked, like, well, what's the meaning of this? I'd be like, I don't really know. I don't even know, like, who I am at this point. So, I mean, that didn't, like, really start changing for me until, like, this past year. And it was because of a lot of like personal things that had happened too, where I was like, okay, now is the time for me to really discover like who I am. Like, I want to be proud of me being Muslim. You know, how do I show that in my work? And who cares if people don't get it? Because I'm just like, I am not an encyclopedia. And it's also your responsibility as the viewer when you see something to do that research like on your own. Post-October, I think that's like when I really stopped caring. Like, I think I just post things and I go like, if this makes someone mad, like they're not worth being in my life, because why would I want to be associated or connected to anyone who supports a genocide? To be very blunt. And I guess like this is also a question you could answer too. It's like, sometimes I do wonder like if one day I will get canceled, if I will have like opportunities taken from me or prevented from me even like considering because of how outspoken I've become. And that's like a difficult thing for me to, I guess, like try to reconcile in my head, because it goes back to that, like, would it have had been worth it if I have a like an opportunity that was taken from me because I am like pro-Palestinian? Or because I am very outspoken against this genocide.
In terms of like getting canceled, I don't know. I haven't really thought about it, but it is kind of emotionally there for me. I just haven't really like unpacked it yet. I have had like people advise me of like, well, you know, artists have always kind of been in that situation. Like, the stronger your work is, the more you have to say, like, you're going to get some pushback. And, like, it existed in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And I'm just like, I guess that's true. But yeah. I also feel like in this day and age, if you do get canceled, like, and you're in Milwaukee, like, is there a support system for that? I don't know if there is.
I really don't know what support system looks like anymore. I mean, it kind of like going back to that like isolation that I think both of us felt when we were at UWM, I'm starting to feel that again. And I find myself pretty uncomfortable now in some art spaces, like in gallery spaces, especially because so many of them have been indifferent. And this is something that I've said to other people where I'm just like, I don't know what's worth. I don't know if hatred or indifference is worth. is worse, because both of them, in my opinion, only benefit oppression.
Which is kind of sad, because I feel like, unfortunately, once everything is said and done, that's when they're going to be like, come on in.
Yeah.
Like, we want to know, can we display your work?
And we'll have like, a show all about
it. If you don't display it today,
okay. Yeah.
You can't display it in a year, in two or five or six.
That was Leila Amin and Amala Sam. They spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez as part of our new series called Group Chat. The Republican National Convention is coming to Milwaukee in July. You can help shape our coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find the link at WUWM.com. What you tell us will help inform the stories you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. Coming up, we're exploring dairy in America's dairy land through a feature in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. We all know Wisconsin as America's dairyland, but how much do we actually know about Wisconsin milk? This month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine features a number of articles all about dairy, from the origins of Wisconsin's dairy industry to what it's like to be a modern-day dairy farmer. It explores what milk means to Wisconsin culture. Chris Drosner is the executive editor at Milwaukee Magazine, and he joins me now to talk about Wisconsin dairy. Chris, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Glad to be here, Joy.
So this is an in-depth look at milk. You go through the long history of milk and, of course, Wisconsin's relationship with milk. What are some of the surprising milk facts that you learned while working on this?
That's a great question. So I think the dairy state is our identity, and you know, it's easy to lose track of history with that aspect, but we have a timeline of major events in milk history. And of course, it's focused on Wisconsin, but I mean, it goes back, you know, a lot of other developments in there. But I thought it was really interesting how dairy became so prominent here. And one of the answers was the work of this Wisconsin Dairymen's Association that started. It was founded in 1872 by a guy named William Dempster Hoard, who would later become governor. You know, it kind of set the table for this industry becoming as prominent as it is, with working on regulation and establishing quality standards and setting prices and stuff. It was interesting to me to think about like this kind of like ragtag early Wisconsin agricultural scene, where you've got grain was foremost, even like hop farming was kind of a big thing early on. And then that kind of gave way to dairy. And there's a lot of factors that go into that, obviously, but the kind of policy and regulatory framework that kind of helped establish this policy and regulatory framework is not the most interesting thing, but thinking about the way that marshaled this kind of really diverse agricultural state into what it is today.
As you mentioned, you look at this deep history of milk, specifically in Wisconsin, but that's just one of the ways that you look at milk. What are some of the other ways that you explore the world of milk in this feature?
We really tried to come at it from basically every angle we could think of. There's some stuff on the producer side, like what is it actually like to live and work on a dairy farm in 2024? We follow a dairy farmer she's in Milton, over in kind of South Central Wisconsin. She gamely offered one of our staffers a chance to try to milk a cow. And Brianna Schubert was the writer on that piece. And a lot of this package was actually her idea. So we thought it would be great to send her out and have her milk a cow. And it did not go great. it was a little bit harder than expected. So there's that kind of on the ground perspective. We have some information about the economics of milk today. It's a tough business with, you know, forces that are often beyond farmers' control, which is difficult, obviously. We look at it from producer standpoint of how, you know, they're trying to green their business a little bit with like stuff like digesters and winter cover crops to reduce soil erosion and improve soil quality without, you know, manure runoff and over, you know, getting nutrients into the watershed. There's a lot of interesting things happening on that front. man, we've got like a kind of a rundown of milk advertising over the years, you know, some pretty iconic campaigns there with Got Milk and Does a Body Good. We did a taste test with some kids of some of our staffers, trying to get them to see if they could tell the difference between, you know, these different alternative milks and regular milk and organic milk versus kind of just like plain regular old whole milk. And it was pretty interesting. Like the alternate milks did not fare very well with the kiddos. They, you know, kids kind of famously love milk. And we had a soy and almond and an oat milk. And yeah, lots of thumbs downs on the alt milks. They did like the oat milk on Cheerios, which is of course an oat cereal. So it was kind of a fun thing. So there's a lot of different ways that the story, we have our dining editor breaking down what exactly are all these different dairy products that you find in the cooler case, like what's the difference between skim and whole and half and buttermilk and sour cream and all these different things. Boy, Joy, there's a lot.
You know, it is an interesting kind of behind the scenes look at milk, something, as you said, that all of us engage with here in Wisconsin in one way or another. I also have tried to milk a cow. It was unhappy about that situation. It did try to kick me. You know, they can kick to the side.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I did not care for it. It definitely made me empathize with farmers and perhaps maybe very inexperienced farmers. What was that experience like for your writer? How early did she have to get up in order to follow along with this dairy farmer?
It was pretty early with the drive and everything, but this farm milks almost around the clock. I think it's 6 a.m., 2 p.m., and 10 p.m. So those cows are milked three times a day. So I think she was in the 2 p.m. window of the milking. And of course, like we think of like the pail and the pulling the udder into the pail, but that's not really how it works. Of course, these days they have these elaborate systems like suction, you know, but they sanitize it and then they pop the suction thing on, they give it a squeeze first, and then they pop the suction on and then the milk starts coming. And you think about, they have 750 cows. So you're doing that process 750 times, three times a day. That's a lot.
So as many of our listeners may know, Wisconsin has lost a lot of dairy farms over the last few decades. But there are still a lot of them here in Wisconsin. Of course, we're just talking about them. Your feature also looks at how dairy farms remain profitable. How do they remain profitable in such a, you know, precarious market?
Yeah, we didn't get into this too much in the feature, but Wisconsin is unusual, I guess, on the national scene in having, in retaining a lot of its really small dairy farms. I mean, we have some really huge operations too, but those kind of more human scale operations are still very common here in Wisconsin. And the thing that makes or breaks a year for farmers pretty much all the time is the prices. And that can fluctuate pretty dramatically. I think right now we're somewhere around $19 per hundredweight. I think only dairy uses 100 weight, but it's about 11.6 gallons of milk is in 100 weight. So, and they're getting about $19 ish of that quantity as of February. So just within the past few years, that's ranged from like 17 to 24. So that's a pretty wide range of your primary source of revenue. And if that is low, you have to find other ways to, you know, make ends meet. Labor is a big factor in the balance sheet. Weather is a huge one, because if it's just a bad year for crops, all the prices go up, and the price will sometimes go up as well, but they seem to be kind of independent. And then the big one is Congress. I mean, prices are set, subsidies and all kinds of stuff is set by the federal government, and that can make a big deal. The last farm bill was passed in 2018 that kind of updated all those subsidies and kind of reset the regulatory and subsidy framework for dairy farmers.
Yeah, a lot to deal with for sure. Now, after working on, I mean, I don't exactly know how many stories were in this feature. It was quite a number of them.
It's a lot.
After working on all of this, do you feel like you have a newfound appreciation for the milking arts?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, I have been an editor in the agriculture space for a while in my previous job at a newspaper. So I've always kind of felt like close to agriculture. But, you know, taking the magazine, especially the Mill Mag approach to it, it's a lot different. It's a lot more fun. And, you know, we're trying to inform, entertain kind of in equal measure. And I think we really nailed it with this one. I am excited. I'm going to try to go to a Breakfast on the Farm this year because we have a roundup of a few of those in the Milwaukee area. It's a nice chance to get out there and kind of see where it all comes from firsthand and meet some farmers. And it's great. I mean, being on some of these operations and seeing all their equipment and the animals and, you know, obviously having some eggs and pancakes and whatever, it's a pretty nice event. And those are happening throughout June all around the state. So it'll be pretty exciting.
A nice way to meet the people who put the food on your table.
Yes, right on.
Well, Chris, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Joy.
Chris Drosner is the executive editor at Milwaukee Magazine. You can read the full feature on dairy in the Dairy State in this month's issue of the magazine. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about the 12th annual Heal the Hood Block Party and learn why it's so important to the community. Plus, Bubbler Talk explores Bayview's tallest building, Bayview Terrace. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.